Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It's great to be back on the air with you guys, and hard to believe that we're now into the month of April. And I also find it hard to believe that this coming Saturday, being April the 6th, will mark the Final Four for the men's basketball tournament. I tell you, March Madness officially begins in the month of March, but it ends at the start of April, which is ironic. But I do find it hard to believe that one of my Final Four teams is still in it, being Purdue. The other three teams obviously did not make it to the round of four. The team that I had picked to win was University of Illinois, but unfortunately they lost in the Elite Eight game to Connecticut. I am hoping that some kind of unique history is going to take place when this is all said and done with, and that if Purdue wins the tournament, the whole thing, they will become the second team in the history of the NCAA tournament to do the improbable. The first team was the University of Virginia 5 years ago when they won the whole thing. The year before, they were the number one seed and lost to a 16 seed. Last year, Purdue was a one seed and lost to a 16 seed, making that the second time in the history of the tournament that a one seed had lost to a 16 seed in the first round. Many people never thought the University of Virginia's men's basketball team could have ever recovered from having lost a year earlier as a one seed to even come close to doing the improbable a year later, and it happened. So I'm hoping that I'll get to see a repeat of history be made if Purdue can do the improbable. And if that does happen, it will just remind us that just about anything is possible, even when it comes to sports. You know, history doesn't always have to be revolved around, you know, historical events or people, but even sporting events have history as well. Another good example of sporting events that pertains to history, we can go back to 1980, 44 years ago, when the United States hockey team, a group of 20 college kids, in a time of uncertainty for America, given that America's economy was in shambles, 52 hostages were held against their own will over in Tehran, Iran. Nobody really felt good about being an American, but then you had 20 college kids band together to do the improbable, and that was to not only go up against some of the world's best hockey teams in terms of nations, like the Czechs, the Swedes, the Finns, and then you've got the Soviets, who were really the most daunting of opponents, who had won four straight gold medals in hockey, and then all of a sudden in 1980, here they are on top of the world, you know, government-sponsored magicians, and they are pretty much unstoppable. But for the late U.S. hockey coach Herb Brooks, he wanted to basically take a system, have it be a hybrid system. Maybe it wasn't 100% the same as the Soviets, but a hybrid system where it would be a team that would not rely on all-star talent, being individual talent. It had to be a team where everyone's talents were of significant use, to where all the players could come together and band as one unit and have something in common, and that was to defeat, as Ronald Reagan would say in his presidency, the evil empire, the Soviet Union. Well, what do you know? David slewed Goliath, and not only had we beat the Soviets, but we finally had something good to feel about. We eventually won the gold medal, and there again, we had something to feel good about. It may not have erased at the time the state of the economy or the situation involving the hostages in Iran, but it helped modify or overall state of patriotism when it was sorely needed. So there again, folks, even sporting events can be historic based upon the circumstances at stake. And who knows, if we're lucky enough, we might see history repeat itself for a second time in 5 years, where a number one seed in the NCAA tournament will be able to redeem themselves given what happened the year before. Well, what I do know is that many of you have taken this new podcast book topic series with a great enthusiastic attitude, given that I've seen almost 30 plays per the previous days, or not the previous day, but from a couple of days ago, the prologue that we were introduced to being Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool. Well, in this podcast segment episode, we're going to learn about whether or not the New England region had anything valuable commodity-wise that was worth exporting. We will learn about what Massachusetts merchants did not fully appreciate in terms of what was available within the confines of their territory with regards to shipping something that only a select few saw as being unique and possibly trying to ship, but the majority didn't. Of course, I know some of us probably already know the answers, but the bottom line is I'm just trying to give you all a good indication or a start of where we're going, because this is going to be a unique story of how an individual, being Frederick Tudor, is going to have to overcome a lot of odds. He wants to ship ice to places where nobody would ever even dream of wanting to ship to. It has nothing to do with, say, shipping ice to southern states or shipping to the Caribbean. It's just the problem is that, okay, if you're going to ship this stuff, how are you going to preserve the ice? Who's not to say that once the ice gets loaded onto the vessel or vessels, that it will start to melt? And who's to say that by the time it arrives to its final destination, that there will even be any ice? I probably will be saying that a lot, not just in this podcast segment episode, but probably in other episodes. But we should be reminded that this endeavor, as noted from the prologue, while it will succeed over time, we will have to come to the understanding that success alone is not going to happen overnight. There will be some success, but it will not be the type of success that's going to perhaps, how do I say it? It may not get to the full 50% threshold within a few years. It might get near the 50% threshold, but it might not make it to that exact mark. And we will come to learn over time that even if it does get to the 50% threshold, it will still require, say, another 5 years at best before it exceeds the 50% threshold. So the one thing that Frederick Tudor probably does have is time on his side, but the bigger question is, how much time does he have to prove to the skeptics that are out there? Because the skeptics are from all corners, most notably the Brahmins, the elite, the Bostonian elite. So here we go with our first leadoff question to Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool. Here we go. Did New England as a region have anything valuable commodity-wise to export come 19th century start? I was stunned to find this out, but the answer was no. Well, for one, the New England region is not home to common natural resources like iron and coal. There is plenty of farmland. Of course, when I think of New England in terms of its majestic scenery, I think of the mountains, I think of the coast, and, you know, we can be reminded of farmlands as being something unique, regardless of the season. But the farmland in New England is really of average to lower tier status. In other words, we're not going to find any farms in New England growing tobacco or cotton. those things just don't exist because it's too cold to be growing those kinds of commodities, especially within a region that's not far from Canada. Not just so much because it's near Canada, it's just that it does not have the climate to be producing commodities that I mentioned a moment ago, being tobacco and cotton. But the majority of Boston, Massachusetts's trade was secondhand. What do you mean by secondhand? Well, secondhand here, folks, meaning that New England merchants concentrated heavily on buying and selling other nations' goods, which came into the port of Boston. And once other nations' goods arrived into the port of Boston, once they were unloaded, the New England merchants seized it upon themselves to take goods from other nations and sell them as a means of making money short and long term to people in America. So in other words, instead of investing money in businesses that probably were not going to have long-term success, why not take the goods that you have acquired from those merchants overseas, and once they are in your possession, go about selling them to people in your neck of the woods who have the money to afford them. So is it fair to say that that Bostonians are more dependent upon imports than exports? Oh, the answer is yes. They are far more dependent upon what is coming into them versus what is getting shipped out. However, there is a unique exception here. North of Boston is the village Salem. Of course, when I think of Salem, I always tend to think of the infamous Salem witchcraft trials from 1692. That sadly took the lives of about 20 innocent people. Of course, historians know that there were more lives lost than the 20 in Salem from the year 1692. A fair number of people died in the jails, most notably in Boston, under horrendous conditions. But we also do forget that Salem, Massachusetts, has a port just like Boston, and also like Marblehead. But the port of Salem, being north of Boston, is unique at the start of the 19th century. How so? Because it is one of the very few New England villages that actually exports goods. In other words, Salem, Massachusetts is a unique exception because it's not totally 100% dependent upon all things imported coming into the village. But they do export a select few items, most notably peppercorns. Peppercorns were valued as a key food preservative ingredient prior to the arrival of refrigeration. So peppercorns are going to be used for preserving meats, for example, like, say, a roast beef, ham, maybe, you know, venison. But peppercorns are going to be used to preserve various foods that can last a little bit longer, you know, which is a good thing. But we do have to be reminded that that even in this country, in the United States, prior to refrigeration, we still had to rely upon other methods of good quality food preservation practices. 1805, being the same year that Frederick Tudor lays out his grand scheme for wanting to ship out ice to tropical climates. 1805 is rather a good year for the Port of Salem because the Port of Salem went about re-exporting 7.5 million tons of peppercorn. That's a hefty number, but obviously if they were able to re-export 7.5 million tons of peppercorn to various other nations around the world, then that tells you that that the Port of Salem has, in my opinion, has done a very good job of modifying its overall economic practices to where the people in the village of Salem will benefit from exportation as well as importation of goods. What did Massachusetts's elite merchants fail to understand, or I should say grasp, within their confines from a seasonal standpoint? You know, when I think of the Brahmins here, this elite group of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, we think, you know, it'd be easy to think, well, they seem to know about everything. You wouldn't want to question their authority. But just because they are in the wealthy elite of Bostonian society, maybe it's fair to say that sometimes even those whom are wealthy and elite are not immune to everything around them that they either are taking for granted or simply just don't really care to invest in. So yes, it is probably fair to say that the Bostonian elite, being the Brahmins, are really more concerned about what's going on in their world, but yet as for everyone else's whom doesn't fit into their criteria, then obviously the Brahmins are probably going to treat those people like second-class citizens. Doesn't make it right, but that's what often happened. So as for Massachusetts elite merchants, what did they fail to understand or grasp within their confines from a seasonal standpoint? Well, take the season of winter, which produced more than just snowfall. But during the winter time in New England, something else took place besides snow being covered on the ground. The lakes, ponds, rivers all got frozen solid, hence ice. Okay, your bodies of water are frozen solid during the winter, and that's because it's cold enough to where those bodies of water, if they endure three hard freezes and go past three hard freezes, those bodies of water are going to become frozen solid, hence you have ice. So for the Massachusetts elite merchants, come springtime, all of that ice is going to completely dissolve away. Okay, that's fine. But for Frederick Tudor, he sees it upon himself to realize that that the Massachusetts elite merchants, and knowing that Frederick Tudor himself, his family is part of the Bostonian elite, or what's, you know, the Brahmins, Frederick Tudor knows that people from within this elite inner circle are missing out on something that is ultimately a game changer. It may not be a game changer overnight to them, but this is a game changer that could truly revolutionize how we go about properly using a natural resource so that it will benefit other groups of people living not only elsewhere in the United States, but overseas, whom would give anything in the world to have a very, very precious commodity, aka ice, that would help preserve their foods and beverages long-term, just like we're able to here in a northern climate, aka the New England region of the United States. So Frederick Tudor and his brother William had their grand plan of transporting ice from the New England region down southward to America's southern tier belt, including the West Indies, aka the Caribbean, laid out. But both brothers sought to keep their grand plan a secret, given there was going to be a very strong likelihood of facing intense scrutiny among Boston's elite merchants. And this intense scrutiny, they knew that even if they kept this a secret for, say, another 3 to 6 months, that's one thing. But once it was released out there, I think it's fair to say that Frederick and his brother William knew that they were going to be constantly attacked without any boundaries. And think about it, there's no such thing at this time, obviously, as a 24-hour news. But once word gets out, there's probably not going to be any end in sight in terms of constantly being frowned upon for trying to propose something that very few people know has potential to succeed, but yet 98 to 99% of the public knows that you're just wasting your money. Well, Frederick and his siblings had access to an ice house when they were growing up. The ice house was at Rockwood, a 100-acre farm, where the family escaped to when the weather got hot, most notably within the confines of Boston. Frederick and his siblings accessed ice from the Rockwood Pond. The ice that came from Rockwood Pond was intended to preserve the family's beverages and treats. Special treats, folks, like ice cream. Now, yes, folks, there have been recipes for ice cream that date back to colonial times. Even Thomas Jefferson experimented with various ice cream recipes, not only when he was living at Monticello, but also when he was ambassador to France from 1784 to 1789. But yes, folks, Frederick Tudor has grown up with an ice house. How beneficial, how luxurious. But Frederick Tudor wants to make a difference. And it's not just so much selling ice, but giving ice to other nations around the world whose people would kill to have a commodity that perhaps Frederick knows is being taken granted by the elite. Maybe the Bostonian elite does not want to invest in this concept because they feel as though the people below them won't know what to do with the ice once they have access to it. Well, Frederick Tudor is going to work on plans for how people can not only access the ice, but how they need to go about preserving it. Was young Frederick Tudor supposed to follow in his father's footsteps by attending Harvard? Yes, at age 13, he was sent to Boston Latin School. But while there, he came to a realization that college simply wasn't for him and ended up dropping out. Now, I can't imagine being at the age of 13 during the time that Frederick Tudor was living in. And he was born in 1783, if that gives you any indication. He was born just before the Treaty of Paris went into effect, thus ending the American Revolutionary War altogether. So at about the age of 13 is when George Washington's presidency is coming to an end in 1796. 1796 being the year that Washington issued his farewell address, and part of his farewell address did include the dangers of factions, aka political parties. So yes, at the age of 13, Frederick Tudor, yes, was sent to Boston Latin School, but while there he came to a realization that college just simply wasn't for him. Well, I can only imagine how his dad would have felt about this, but what I do know is that Frederick's father was overseas, I want to say on business, so the elder Mr. Tudor, or he was referred to as the judge, never knew about this. After dropping out from Boston Latin School, Frederick took on an apprenticeship at a store in Boston. But not long afterwards, he gave up the apprenticeship only to spend his entire time at Rockwood Farm by hunting and fishing. I know some of us would be thinking to ourselves right now, what is wrong with Frederick here? It's almost as if he's throwing away his life. It's almost as if he's not trying to make something of his life. I would agree with you all here, but let's not rush to conclusions. At age 17, this was the age when Frederick first realized that there was potential for shipping ice southward to the West Indies, that there is a good possibility that something like this can happen. So age 17, in the year he turns 17 years of age in 1800, and of course 1800 is going to mark the first time when for one, America's capital is relocated from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., but it will also mark the first time in a political election where one party, being the party that's in power, will no longer be in power come the following year when the new president gets inaugurated, come March of 1801 when Thomas Jefferson ushers in the Jeffersonian Revolution. Where one party is no longer going to be in power, it will ultimately come apart in the second decade of the 19th century, but the election of 1800 is a revolutionary one, given that it is ultimately the transfer of power from one party to another that had not been seen since the Republic itself had first been established. So at age 17, yes, Frederick is now beginning to realize that there is potential for shipping ice southward to the West Indies. Now, Frederick is one of at least five siblings, at best, five or six siblings who will make it into adulthood. He did lose some siblings that died in infancy. But one of Frederick's brothers, named John Henry Tudor, he was about age 19 in 1801. Sadly, he was left as an invalid due to a bad knee. Now think about this, folks. We don't have any kind of arthroscopic knee surgery practices back then. We don't have knee replacements. So if you have really bad knee conditions, sadly, you could be left an invalid. When we think of in today's time, we could take care of that problem in a heartbeat, for the most part, given how far the advances in medicine have come. But Frederick, with the assistance from his father, took brother John southward, where they started in Havana, Cuba. But late May 1801, brother John's knee continued to worsen. June of 1801, the brothers bought a passage, that is, they bought a ticket on ship bound north for Charleston, South Carolina. The brothers, after spending time in South Carolina, they found both Havana, Cuba, and Charleston, South Carolina to be very humid. But of course, in Frederick's eyes, okay, this is these areas are very humid, but wouldn't people down here give anything in the world to have a block of ice that they could use for chilling their foods and their beverages, just to make life a little bit more hospitable when dealing with such oppressive heat? He'll be saying that a lot. Well, after spending time in South Carolina, the brothers went further north to a place called Bath, Pennsylvania, which is located outside of Lehigh, where they were in search of a spa with regards to John Tudor's deteriorating knee. In other words, they were looking for like a mineral spa, something that could be used to a facility where his brother, where Frederick's brother John could get proper medical ailment treatment for a knee condition that simply was not going to get any better. Well, despite all the best efforts in trying to improve John's condition, sadly, come late January of 1802, John Tudor died. I don't know if he had even reached age 20, but sadly he died because of his knee condition. After John's passing, what did Frederick's father go about doing for him? Frederick went to work at a mercantile firm where he would spend 2 years coordinating shipments with goods from pimento, nutmeg, sugar, to tea. Well, when I think of pimentos, you know, they're little peppers that, you know, you might put in, like, say, pimento cheese or stuffed pimentos in olives. And, of course, when I think of, you know, tea, I think of colonial times with the American Revolutionary War. But given that we're now in the post-American Revolutionary time frame, I think it's fair to say that coordinating shipments of tea are not going to be met with as much hostility as they would have been nearly 30 years beforehand. William Tudor, Frederick's father, is now finally convinced that young Frederick knows for himself what he wants to pursue. Perhaps it could be real estate, given that Boston as a city at this particular time at the start of the 19th century is growing rather quickly. And not only is Boston as a city growing, but big profits are being made by those who owned land where buildings already stand or would soon get built. So it is fair to say that right now is a good time to be in Boston. A lot of happenings are taking place. Now, this might seem odd for me to mention, but even this has a little bit of a unique story. Now, when I think of June 25th as a date, it just so happens that back on June 25th of 2005, hard to believe that's been almost 19 years, that was the date that my wife and I got married. So we've been married for almost 19 years. How about we forward back 200 years earlier on June 25th, 1805? Frederick Tudor's sister, Emma Jane Tudor, married Robert Hallowell Gardner. And why is Robert Hallowell Gardner important? His father served as tax collector to the Port of Boston prior to the War of Independence breaking out. As a matter of fact, his family moved to England, where they lived for 6 years, and then came back to Massachusetts in 1782. It could very well have been that perhaps that Robert's father took his family with him to England as a means of avoiding any kind of further assaults. Avoiding any chances on a family member being attacked by an angry crowd or the mob, aka angry crowd. I mean, there are multiple reasons why some people left to go to England. It wasn't so much all because of loyalty, but more so as a means of safety concerns. Well, it turns out that Robert Gardner, not only is he a Harvard graduate, but he is a member of the New England elite, the Brahmins. It was during Emma and Robert's wedding that brothers Frederick and William Tudor ultimately decided to move forward with their venture, the ice trade shipping business. Let's forward to August the 1st of 1805, pardon me. Frederick wrote his first entry in a journal pertaining to plans for transporting ice into tropical climates. 11 days later, on August 12th of 1805, he wrote a second entry in his journal advising he would be journeying with a cousin to visit Niagara Falls and planned to return to Massachusetts come October. I'm wondering if this is going to be a leisure trip. It sounds like a leisure trip, but we might, we could be in for a surprise. However, at the same time, Frederick and brother William were implementing their plans for the first ice shipment come winter 1805 to 1806. And both brothers were hoping to turn to Congress, folks. It's one thing to turn to your state legislature, but to turn to Congress is a whole nother game. So both brothers were hoping to turn to Congress for financial support, and not just financial support for an endeavor that had never been attempted before, but they are also hoping that they will receive a monopoly on this particular trade practice. For one, it's special. Two, nobody else has engaged in it. So we should, you know, have sole rights to the trade itself. Well, it's one thing to want to pursue a monopoly, but wouldn't you think if you wanted to pursue a monopoly that you would have had extraordinary successes, both big and small, before wanting to pursue the monopoly? I think so. But could it be that Frederick Tudor is caught up in the moment? Could it be that he's under this assumption that no matter where people dig holes in the ground, that it's going to be cold enough for ice itself to be preserved? I'm going to probably be asking that question again here shortly. But let's just think about it and keep it in your thoughts for this at this particular moment. What factor or issue remained uncertain for Frederick within the present moment in late 1805? The answer is the following. Whether or not an entire shipment of ice cut directly from Rockwood Pond on the family's estate would survive fully intact from Boston's port all the way south into tropical climate regions. Okay, we could cut a couple of blocks of ice out of Rockwood Pond, and I could place them on a ship. But is there a guarantee that the ice itself is going to stay frozen solid once cut from the lake, or I should say cut from the pond, once entering onto the ship? And is it going to stay frozen if it's going to have to stop somewhere else en route? After all, folks, I mean, ships just can't go from one end to another without stopping. We have to be reminded of the fact that here we are at the start of the 19th century, and ships are still relying upon the wind as a means of getting going. And if it's not right away to your final destination, it's probably going to be to somewhere at a halfway point along the way. So remember, folks, we don't have keys to start the ships, and like, you know, we do with cars, starting the ignition, backing up, and putting it then in drive, and here we go onward to our destination. No, we don't have that kind of technological luxury. We're going to be a long ways off from that. But yes, if I'm Frederick Tudor, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty, but one uncertain factor is, or element is the following, is that whether or not an entire shipment of ice that I cut directly from Rockwood Pond on the family's estate is going to survive fully intact from Boston's port all the way south into a tropical climate region. That could be, say, all the way down to Charleston, South Carolina. It could be Savannah, Georgia, just throwing out some examples of southern ports, cities. What about somewhere in the Caribbean? You know, there are no guarantees, but these are the things that are going to have to weigh very heavily on Frederick's mind. Well, one step Frederick takes, and this is a good step, but it may not mean that he's guaranteed anything, but he's obviously taking a good step in the right direction. Frederick wrote a letter to Massachusetts U.S. Senator named Harrison Gray Otis, another member of the Brahmin Network. And Harrison Gray Otis, his family, the Otis family, is a very prominent political family in Massachusetts. Whenever I think of the Otises, I think of James Otis Jr. Why James Otis Jr.? Well, he was an ardent patriot, for one, just like his father, but two, James Otis Jr. is someone we have to thank when it comes to writs of assistance. In other words, during the height of the Boston Tea Party movement, British inspectors or customs officials were allowed to, after they had gotten off their vessels, they were allowed to inspect anyone else's vessel, but by doing so without proper cause. In other words, if John Smith, a British inspector, said, "I suspect Tom Jones has got some kind of illegal contraband on his ship, so I'm going to go inspect it right now." Well, here's the thing, John Smith: do you have probable cause? Do you have a valid search warrant? If you don't have any valid probable cause or a valid search warrant, then you are not allowed to enter the premises of Tom Jones's ship. So we have James Otis Jr. to thank for establishing writs of assistance that basically safeguarded people's liberties, most notably what we know in today's time as the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, being the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizures. So prior to the American Revolutionary War breaking out, and just a few years after the Boston Massacre, British customs officials are not only seizing our ships, but they are doing so without engaging in the proper channel network of how to go about conducting a proper search and seizure that must rely upon full probable cause and a proper valid search warrant. So anyways, yes, U.S. Senator Harrison Gray Otis is related, directly related to James Otis Jr. and other members of the Otis family. And there is an Air Force base in Massachusetts called Otis Air Force Base, named after the Otis family. Well, Frederick Tudor writes to Senator Harrison Gray Otis and explains his case behind why ice as a commodity should supersede other common essentials, given the vast majority of people within and outside the United States would benefit from ice during warmer seasons as a means of preserving foods and beverages long term. Frederick himself is a bit naive, given his assumptions centered on the fact that once someone dug a hole in the ground, they would reach cooler ground for ice to be preserved. Boy, that's a lot of wishful thinking right there, but we'll find out here soon if, in fact, this is something that's even relevant based upon this philosophical concept that Frederick already has in his mind. Did Frederick, on his journey westward into Niagara Falls, stumble upon any existing ice houses? Yes, he did. Two altogether, with one of them located in upstate New York. The ice house in New York State, which Frederick came upon, comprised of three walls above ground, but just one wall cut into the ground, aka the dirt. Frederick, another disadvantage that Frederick has, and, you know, yes, it's one thing to have some disadvantages, but it's up to you as an individual to learn what you say don't already know and take what you've learned and carry it with you forward so that when it's time to take the next step, you'll have a better concept and understanding of what you're trying to achieve, not just short-term, but long-term. For Frederick Tudor, he doesn't have any scientific background knowledge as to how ice houses operated, most notably from a thermodynamic standpoint. And I don't think most people would have had any true fundamental knowledge of how ice houses were to be operating, most notably from a thermodynamic standpoint. And I didn't really know much about thermodynamics until having read this book. So for those of you who aren't really sure what thermodynamics are, I'll tell you right now. Thermodynamics pertains to the study of relations between heat, work, temperature, and energy. And of course, energy is not just one factor or element, folks. Energy pertains to anything that could be mechanical, electrical, chemical, just to name a few things. So basically, thermodynamics is the transfer of energy from one place to another and from one form to another. Frederick's letter to U.S. Senator Harrison Gray Otis entailed the concept requiring one to dig downward of a few feet anywhere throughout the world to find cool terrain where ice could be easily stored. Over time, this notion or belief would prove to be entirely false, and it's very true, because just because you're digging in one area, let's say you're digging in the New England region in the United States, it's not going to be the same terrain as say down south in Charleston, South Carolina, or you know Savannah, Georgia. It's not going to be the same as say you know maybe Havana, Cuba. Or where we learned in our prologue, which I know many of you were stunned to learn about, and that will, and we will talk about that later on, but that he ultimately, with the course of times, thoroughly prevailed to where he proved the skeptics even more so wrong by transporting ice 16,000 miles across the oceans to Calcutta, India. So it would be fair to say that that the soil or terrain in New England is not going to be anywhere close to the terrain and soil that would be needed for building an ice house in Calcutta, India. So, yes, for Frederick Tudor, he's going to have to come to the realization that just because one digs downward of a few feet anywhere throughout the world, the terrain itself is not going to be alike. No two terrains are going to be the same. Did European colonial powers, most notably England, France, and Spain, each have various sets of policies pertaining to trade? Yes, they did. And I think that's something that we could easily forget. Each nation's policies were always subject to change. And you have to remember, folks, the United States is trading with these nations, primarily with England, but there is some trade with France, and there is some trade with Spain. But European colonial powers of England, France, and Spain, each nation's policies were always subject to change, given that any treaty that took place between any one of those nations and the United States were always subject to change, given that the treaties themselves, while being made, constantly faced great likelihoods of getting broken, especially during wartime. So in 1805, there is the Battle of Trafalgar, where Admiral Horatio Nelson leads British forces to a triumphant victory. And yes, while the British are triumphantly celebrating their victory, this would have an impact on France and Spain in terms of their trade relations with, say, the United States and with other nations, but most notably with the United States. The year 1805, the United States is just over a quarter of a century old, 29 years old. The United States is constantly having to adjust its policies on trade when taking into account sudden or unexpected shifts regarding European nation supremacy and loyalty. After all, you know, we have two political parties. The Federalists are more on the side of England. The Anti-Federalists, or the Jeffersonian Republicans, are far more pro-French. Frederick Tudor, in the midst of everything that's going on, conflict-wise in 1805, Frederick Tudor has decided to seek out an island that is a French island known as Martinique in the West Indies as his first choice for supplying ice to a tropical climate, not just so much to a tropical climate region, but to a country within the tropical realm whom should be entitled to acquire a commodity that for one, they've probably never really seen before in person. Very few living in Martinique probably have, and two, would kill to have on a yearly basis. So Frederick Tudor seeks out the French island of Martinique as his first choice, given the other choice, Havana, Cuba, would lead to greater attention to his overall mission a bit sooner than expected. Well, think about, you know, Cuba is in the hands of the Spanish. But it is fair to say that that Spain's presence is still weighing heavily strong in the United States, most notably along the Mississippi River and with what we know as present-day Florida. What did Frederick Tudor seek to establish regarding sole rights to his ice trade industry? He sought a monopoly, exclusive rights for the entire ice trade, given without having any broad authority, there would be no means of curtailing competition nor making projected profits he had been envisioning all along. So it's one thing to want to request a monopoly, but just because you have a monopoly, yes, you could eliminate the competition, but you're not guaranteed that you'll be able to reap every ounce of profit-making right away. Frederick's brother William and cousin James Savage each spoke French fluently. Mrs. Tudor, Frederick and William's mother, had multiple connections in France. So this is one of this is a primary reason why William and Frederick and William are choosing Martinique, because for one, it's a French colony, and two, their mother has multiple connections with people in France. And as for the main town along the island of Martinique, Saint-Pierre's population is about 30,000 people. To have a population of that size, Frederick and William Tudor truly believe in their hearts that because Saint-Pierre has a population of 30,000, that it's going to be enough of a population to sustain, where demand will always be high enough for many customers requesting, or I should say wanting, to purchase Rockwood ice. Well, yes, it's one thing to have a good, steady population. On the other hand, just because you have a good, steady population of people living somewhere, can you be 100% sure that once they receive the commodity that they're going to know how to go about preserving it? This is where some trial and error is going to take place down the road here soon. Did U.S. Senator Harrison Gray Otis support Frederick Tudor's enterprise? I was surprised to learn of this, but at the same time, maybe I shouldn't have been. But I also know that based upon what I've told you all earlier, that Frederick Tudor is going to be facing a lot of criticism and scrutiny from within the inner circles, being that of the Brahmins, the Bostonian elites. But as for the question of did U.S. Senator Harrison Gray Otis support Frederick Tudor's enterprise, there are two answers. One is yes, and two is a no. Senator Otis support Frederick Tudor's enterprise? He supported Frederick Tudor's enterprise on the grounds that he truly did believe that young Frederick's plan behind transporting ice from one climate to another, or I should say setting, or from one climate to another setting, aka region, was in fact doable. It could be done as long as you had the right resources, as long as you had the proper means of, say, insulating the ice, as long as you had done your homework and knew that you could transport this and still come just shy of making a profit, even if it meant breaking 50-50, that perhaps it could be done. As for the spectrum where we would be saying no, Senator Otis did not provide direct funding to Frederick Tudor. Given that Senator Otis himself did not want his own name tied into an investment where money itself not only did not get made, but that if there were more losses versus profits, that Senator Otis would be forced to pay out losses versus reaping surplus rewards, aka positive investment returns. So think of like Senator Otis as like a shark from Shark Tank. Frederick Tudor has written to his senator asking him for support with this new endeavor. Well, Senator Otis likes the idea, but the question is, for Senator Otis, he's got to be very passionate about this. He's got to see results. If he doesn't see results that have occurred prior to a proposal now, then why should he be willing to risk raising money out of his own pockets, or let alone asking Congress as an entire body to raise money for something that simply could end up not only being a waste of their own pocketbook expense, but perhaps what we would call in today's time a waste of federal taxpayer dollars. So for Senator Otis, it's a double-edged sword. It's also something that, yes, he does believe could happen one day, but right now his heart is not set in that right direction, or is not set in the direction that that Frederick Tudor would like for him to be in. And on one hand, if I were in Senator Otis's shoes, I would have to think long and hard about whether or not I'd want to invest the money, because if I invested my money into this endeavor and I did not even get a 50-50 investment return, where say 50, we netted 50% of sales, but yet we lost 50% because we didn't know how to properly insulate the ice or keep the ice, as much of the ice frozen, then what does it go to show you? I mean, does it say that, is this a good investment? And most people would say no. So for Senator Otis, I can see where he is very skeptical about wanting to provide direct funding to Frederick Tudor, given that he just doesn't want his name tied into an investment where money is not only not getting made, but he'll be paying out more of a loss, or I should say a deficit, versus reaping all the surplus rewards. In other words, he doesn't want to see his name get tarnished because he invested in something that did not yield true fundamental results. And he would be ridiculed by people within the inner circle, the Brahmins. And he doesn't have time to be ridiculed by members of his own inner circle. Once more people within Boston learned of Frederick's enterprise, the greater the criticism he endured. And believe it or not, his own father's outlook was one that favored advising his son altogether to end this crazy dream. But Frederick chose to remain persistent, given he sought achieving something which everyone else, most notably the Brahmin elite, viewed as reckless. I remember in the movie Rudy, wonderful movie, that there was a scene in the movie, one of Rudy's friends had tragically passed away at the steel mill, and he had to do some soul searching. He wanted to pursue his dreams by going to Notre Dame. And Rudy came from a blue-collar family. And of course, back in that day, white-collar families could afford to send their children to college. Blue-collar families, I'm not saying that it couldn't have happened, but there was probably more of a divide between what was affordable and what wasn't. But in the movie, I remember the late Ned Beatty saying to Sean Astin, who played Rudy, he said to him, you know, Notre Dame is for rich kids, great athletes. It's not for us. You're a Rudiger. You've got a great life here. You could be working at the steel mill just like your brothers are. You could be making great money, and one of your brothers is going to be getting a promotion soon here where he's going to be making more than I will, and that's a great life. And Sean Astin, playing Rudy, said to his dad very politely, Dad, I don't want to be like Frank and Johnny. I love them, but working the steel mill is not for me. Maybe what Frederick Tudor is trying to tell his father is that, look, whatever you want me to go into is one thing, but maybe it's not for me. Let me pursue my dream. Let me work with this dream over time. Yes, people out there are probably going to say that I'm wasting money, but maybe I'm on to something. Maybe I'm going to prove the skeptics wrong, because if I don't do it, who's going to do it? Who's going to pursue this dream of wanting to transport ice, not only ice from New England down into southern part of the United States, but ultimately outside the United States into the Caribbean, and perhaps one day is all the way to the Far East as India, Calcutta, India. So the bottom line is that maybe it's okay not to be like what everybody else is doing, but if you know that you've got your heart and mind set on something, where, and knowing that everybody else is telling you you're nuts for pursuing this, the best thing might be to do is to tune them out. And in the end, when it's all said and done with, over time, maybe it's fair to say Frederick will be the one that will have the last laugh. Well, that covers it for this podcast segment episode. When I'm on the air again next, we're going to learn about details behind the first upcoming journey in transporting ice to Martinique. Take care for now, and wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe.